This is The Guardian.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. The Premier League is back, and if you can't remember what was happening 6 weeks ago, it's okay because it's all basically the same. Arsenal are really good and being taken seriously by everyone who secretly still thinks Manchester City will win the league. Newcastle are really good. Eddie Howe is too, and Miguel Almiron. Insert your own caveats about where the money comes from. Spurs are really good at doing nothing for at least 45 minutes. Everton are really not good and are in trouble. Darwin Nunez is good but also isn't good at the same time. Fulham are still better than you thought they were, and Brighton just can't put it in the back of the net. No, that's the only thing that's changed. That was under Graham Potter. Hopefully the panel will add a few more adjectives to the above, answer your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Lars Sivertsen, welcome.
Good morning, Max.
Hello, Jordan Jarrett Bryan.
Hello, pal.
And hello, John Bruin.
Hello, Max.
Let's begin at the Emirates then. Arsenal are, 7 points clear now at the top of the Premier League. To second place Newcastle after that 3-1 win over West Ham. And I wonder, Jordan, as an Arsenal fan, and I know you still are refusing to say they're in the title race, that was really impressive because at halftime at 1-0 down, even though you were playing quite well, you could imagine that would be the moment where everyone goes, okay, it was all a joke before the World Cup.
You say that, but I'm not sure. I think we were playing well enough in that first half, Max, that I'd like to think, and the gentleman may disagree, but like to think that people would still think the goal's coming. They're playing well enough that even though they're 1-0 down, mm-hmm. I still have faith they can and will turn this around. I wasn't at any point overly panicked. I think we were doing the right things well. And yeah, I just think a half-time jolt from Mikel Arteta, again, I'd like to believe, was just keep doing what you're doing. The goal will come. Don't deviate. Don't panic. The goal will come. So There would have been a lot of people that were pre-match thinking, okay, let's see how good this Arsenal team are. A, momentum has been halted by the World Cup, and B, their star striker is now out. Let's see what you're made of. And I think Arsenal, albeit against the West Ham side that aren't amazing, I think, you know, it's another tick for me. 1-0 down, what's going to happen here? And they turned it around, I think, quite convincingly. So I don't know if people were at 1-0 down panicking and thinking, oh yeah, okay, here we go, because I wasn't. And I was pleased with some of the goals. I thought Granit Xhaka was great. I know Odegaard got man of the match, but I thought the constant recycling of the ball when we had them penned in from Partey and Xhaka, I thought was really, really impressive. Just keeping that pressure on, keep creating chances, the goal will come. Eddie Nketiah, a lot of pressure he's been under. I thought he was brilliant in that first half, just didn't get a goal. Second half got his goal. And I think he's like the Sylvain Wiltord now for us now of this right. season. He's got to be the guy that comes in and gets those 7 to 10 goals that are crucial. And I think he got a big goal yesterday that will be good for his confidence. So yeah, really good win for the Arsenal. And on we go.
And I think John, you know, Jordan's right. They play with such fluidity, and none more so than that Nketiah goal, which is just a beautiful goal, wasn't it?
Yeah, I suppose that would be the highlight. But throughout that game, yeah, the player for me was actually Odegaard, because it felt like every time the ball came to him, things are happening. His vision, plays with his head up. He's aware of the players around him. Now, I suppose when we're a goal down, we'd be thinking, are they missing Gabriel Jesus? But of course, what we forgot maybe, or what I forgot, was that he hadn't scored for 10 goal games before this. And that isn't necessarily what he's brought to the team. But Eddie Nketiah did a fair job, I thought, of facsimiling the Jesus effect of just chasing, harrying, The piece, I use this phrase because I actually went to Arteta's press conference in the week, a yard dog. And I think Eddie Nketiah did that job. And I was delighted for him to score that goal because it's his first Premier League goal of the season, an awful lot of pressure. I did wonder whether Mikel Arteta would play him in that game or whether he would decide to put one of Saka and Martinelli and jiggle around and go false nine or something like that. But Arsenal were excellent and reminded us of just how good they've been this season. And I did think it was a shame that when they were to go down, I did think it would be a shame if that 14 games would suddenly just be cast aside and, we're back with Arsenal. Though there was that Jonah figure that did appear in the stadium, Arsene Wenger. And yeah. I did think as soon as he arrived, I thought, oh, here we go. You know, the master of a good start to a season and things coming apart. But no. And the football they played at certain parts of that game would remind of almost peak Wenger. They were absolutely brilliant, Arsenal.
At what point, Lars, do they become, you know, we're now taking them seriously. They're now in the race, right? Is that the official, is that what it is officially? They're not the favourites yet, are they? But like, I know we only played a third of the season. They're such an impressive team.
Yeah, they really are. And I think what the lads have touched on, let's go very dressing room very early on.
It was an interesting moment before the game where we took all of Jordan's stuff out of his room and put it in the garden and made it, but exactly how it had been placed in his room. And it was this incredible banter. Then we cut up his
shoes. The lads touched on, I thought, was the... almost the eye-catching thing here is that even though they were 1-0 down at halftime, even though all the like the narrative cogs and the machinery were there to go, ooh, it's going to go wrong, at no point did you think they were going to lose that game. Like, I was totally certain they were going to turn it around. Also, lads, it's West Ham, because as much as West Ham have done a lot of good work under David Moyes, you know, finishing sixth, finishing seventh, that's good stuff. No one thought that was going to happen when David Moyes came back to West Ham. I've looked at this in their last 2.5 seasons away to so-called top six teams in the league. In the 2020-21 season, they had no wins, one draw, five defeats, even though they finished sixth. The next season, 2021-2022, they had no wins, no draws, six defeats, despite finishing seventh. So far this season, away to top six teams in the league, no wins, no draws, and four defeats. So in the last 2.5 seasons, 15 defeats, one draw, and not a single win away to the top six teams in the league for West Ham. You know, that's those kind of streaks, that can be coincidence, but that's too much of a sample size, I think, for it to be a coincidence. I think they're just not getting these games right.
Yeah, Johansson says it's David Moyes, the most stubborn Scot since Mel Gibson. His refusal... I mainly put it in for that. His refusal to change tactics and starting 11 is surely going to cost him and or West Ham. On the subject of number 14s, you know, not an insignificant number at Arsenal, Thierry Henry was doing the summarising, and Ian noticed this, and it's a very good spot, probably not the only one to notice it. When Arsenal got that penalty, when Aaron Cressel headed it, at half-time, Thierry Henry said, someone should have told the ref that Cresswell headed that. He said, with his history, surely that is on a par with Kwasi Kwarteng criticising the next budget for adding to the country's fiscal instability. Yeah, you would have loved, I mean, at the moment, you know, I wouldn't probably have picked up on it had I been hosting that going, remember the Ireland game, mate? Did you, like, you could have possibly said something? Anyway, sorry, you wanted to make a point, Jordan.
Just on Arsenal, I think as well as Arsenal played, and it's a good reminder, it was a must win, a good reminder to not only the league, but themselves, that they are a good team. This team, for me, is not good enough to hold off City for the long haul. They have to bring in a couple of additions for me. And I know that Mudryk, I think that's how you pronounce his name.
Yeah. He's a brilliant player. He's an absolutely brilliant player.
I don't know a lot about him, but it looks like that deal is going to be done very soon. But they have to reinforce the midfield as well. My only contribution on West Ham is Declan Rice. I know I'm probably the only person on the planet, Max, here, but I just don't see the player that everybody else sees.
Oh, no. No, he is good.
Oh, God.
Oh, no, Jordan. Oh, no, this is
here
one
we go
of those.
Again.
Oh, dear.
The hot takes have been served.
It's like he's the second coming. I'm like, he's a good player, but I'm still waiting to see the player everyone else sees. I'm sorry. I just don't.
The only thing I would say to that, Jordan, is you're Declan Rice, but, you know, if you swap shirts in that game, everything he does is suddenly so much easier, right? He's lugging a team of, you know, West Ham aren't bad, but, like, if you put him in a good team, he would be, Sensational. You wanted to talk, John, yeah?
Yeah, I was just going to say, knowing a couple of West Ham fans, the talk is that Rice is off. And they're in that mindset, you know, when players suddenly, they think the player's leaving, how much effort is he putting into this game? And reading body language in that way. I disagree with Jordan's diagnosis of Declan Rice. He's obviously a very, very talented player. Funny enough, I think the Declan Rice, he probably could be like the most Rolls-Royce centre-back still because of the way that he is. But anyway, he didn't have a good game. I mean, Jordan would be entitled to say that. That's true.
Last quick one on Mudryk. He is a star, isn't he?
Well, he's incredible. He's a star in the making. You know, but what I'm wondering, it's such an interesting balancing act for Arsenal, because I don't disagree with what the notorious JJB said about the squad depth, right? I definitely think this is the time to do something because they have a real shot at winning the league, but there are a couple of positions where they don't have a lot of depth, so try to do something in January. But with Mudryk, you're going to spend a lot of money on a player who's presumably going to come in and take Martinelli's place in the team, because that's kind of where he would be. And you're not going to sign someone like him with that sort of profile and price tag without putting him straight in the team, or without, you know, he's being slotted to play every week. And is kicking young Martinelli out of the team the thing you should be doing right now? ? I mean, but then again, signing good players is always good. I mean, we'll get to this discussion when we come to Cody Gakpo later in this episode. It's one of those where they have to really think very carefully about what they're doing, Arteta and Edu, because it's working so well right now. And sometimes, you know, adding something good to something that's already good can upset things a little bit.
Adding chips to spaghetti bolognese.
That's what I'm saying.
There, exactly. Leicester 0, Newcastle 3. I really thought this was going to be a tricky one for Newcastle, but it wasn't. I mean, at all. Jeff says, considering they're second and we're a week away from the transfer window, and Newcastle now actual title contenders, 6 on the spin they've won, 7 points behind Arsenal. Chris said, while those Mackems, Barry and Wilson are off, come on, talk about how good Newcastle are. Second in the league. Guy says, is Miguel Almiron the best player to have ever lived? And actually, Harvey asked a good question, I think, which is, where would you put Newcastle in terms of squad strength? And how much are they punching above their weight, John? Because it's true, I still look at that squad and I think, what is that? 7th, 8th most talented squad in the league, maybe?
Yeah, you'd certainly say they're playing above themselves, but I suppose that doesn't account for the improvement in certain players. So Joe Linton obviously is the keynote of that, because that is not the Joe Linton we saw 2 years ago. Now, there is some argument over whether he actually ever was a striker anyway, and what Newcastle were doing trying to, you know, remake him the new Andy Cole or whatever. But he's been brilliant. Almiron, is the greatest ever graduate of MLS? Because, you know, into Premier League football, because he has been, this season, he's been absolutely sensational. And he's also become something to beat Jack Grealish with. But yeah, you look through that team and there isn't, and this is the thing that Newcastle fans will always point to, won't they? That, okay, they've spent money, but Eddie Howe has improved players, and that has been the foundation behind them being so good. I suggest, though, Leicester were a little bit caught cold. Brendan Rodgers and defending of set pieces and defending in general. Now, of course, their excellence in defending, because they had kept a good run of clean sheets before Christmas or before the World Cup. And Wout Faes, who didn't actually play much for Belgium at the World Cup, does appear to have been as though he's under the tutelage of Roberto Martinez in some of his defending. There seems to be a lot of running past static Leicester players in that game, which I thought, because Leicester were a crisis club, then they weren't a crisis club. So as much as we can talk about Newcastle, and actually it being a strange season, is there any reason why we would rule Newcastle out of a title challenge at this point? I don't think so. Do Leicester go back into the crisis club section?
I would very much like to deploy my sort of half MLS nerdery here.
Please,
because John Bruin brings him up, and I think you're right to talk about him in those terms. the thing I would say about Miguel Almirón is there was a period around 2018 where, you're not going to believe me, but I'm going to say it anyway, Atlanta United were one of the most fun teams to watch anywhere in the world. They were so good. And they were playing a very sort of high-pressing, everyone get forward, run like crazy type of style. And Almirón was just key to that. And I used to watch sit up at night and watch them, not because I'm an idiot and have lifestyle issues, but because they were just amazing. And then Almirón left that team to go to Newcastle and has played a couple of years under the Benitez and then Steve Bruce Newcastle United team, where he basically never got the ball anywhere near the opponent's goal ever. You know, there was just no attacking play happening. You know, any chance you want to score, Miggy, you're going to have to make yourself. And instead of getting the ball, being fed the ball around the box a lot and having a lot of opportunities to affect the game, he kept like having to make these mad 40-yard dashes to try to get forward. And obviously, he's not going to put up the same kind of numbers, and it's going to start affecting his confidence. What we're seeing this season is again that Almirón, again, is playing in a team that's winning the ball high up the field, is committing a lot of men forwards, and he's just getting many chances to do stuff in and around the box. And it turns out, lo and behold, we're seeing something much closer to the player he was when he played in a similar team in MLS.
Yeah, I think that people talk this season about Xhaka being one of the biggest turnarounds in Premier League history. I think Almirón's up there as well, because I remember, hands up, for about 18 months thinking this guy would be the best player in the Championship. I think he'd be the best player in the Championship by a mile. I didn't think he was a Premier League player. So to see what he's doing right now, fair play, my Declan Rice take in 2 years' time could be one of the worst takes of all time, granted. But on Newcastle, I think John's point is also very true about the coaching that's happening there as well. They're going to buy players and they've got the money to do so. But let's not underestimate the job that Eddie Howe in coaching some of those players to get 20% more out of them, I think, is contributing to how well they're doing this season. My lot, Arsenal have got them in a couple of weeks' time, which I think could be a really testing game for both teams in terms of where they finish this season. Just on Leicester briefly as well, I find Leicester a really weird side because whenever I watch them, they're never that bad. I look at them, I think, you're not that bad, but yet you seem to losing, and then they got like a good run of four games, and Leicester one, they are the new Everton in that they shouldn't, I don't know, they're an odd team, and I just look at them and think to myself, how are you in the bottom eight of the table, but yet whenever I see you play, you seem to be not that bad. It's weird.
Yeah, they didn't have a shot on target till the 82nd minute, which is an issue.
I've got a suggestion on Leicester. You know, there's this. Okay, we've wondered what the effect of the World Cup would be. And then we watched this day of football and realised that the World Cup had absolutely no effects on anything. But I wonder if Leicester are one of those teams that are affected by the World Cup. In that Faust went, didn't play, Maddison went, didn't play. And there could be that idea that they've been affected by the World Cup being a you know, not a particularly good experience for their players.
Yeah, possible. And Maddison didn't play yesterday. I don't think he was. I presume he was just at the darts, and so because that's just whenever I the darts happens to be on, and I don't really watch it, but it's like on in the radio studio, or whatever. It always cuts. It's a cutaway of James Maddison. I did want to just mention the penalties. You say Leicester started cold, like Daniel Amati. It's just the biggest foul in the. But it's absolutely hilarious, isn't it? Like,
oh my God.
So like the other team, you know, play like. In any penalty, they complain. No, the defenders complain. But that one, they just went, I did catch him there. Really, I really kicked Joe Linton quite hard.
And I guess this is where you'd have some sympathy with Brendan Rodgers. Like, you worked on stuff. You've maybe had one of those midnight sandwiches like he had at Liverpool when he suddenly discovered how to... Anyway, long story. And you've gone into this game. Like, we got to start it on the right foot this second half of the season. And then after like 2 minutes, you concede like the dumbest penalty in human history. And a couple of minutes later, you concede a great goal to like red hot Miguel Almirón, who's unstoppable at the moment. And less than 10 minutes on the clock, you find yourself 2-0 down to a Newcastle team that hasn't lost in several years, it seems. And you think, well, this isn't going to be a good Boxing Day, is it?
No. I mean, maybe he didn't say nothing silly first five. He just said nothing silly first two. So Daniel Amati looked at the clock and went, it's the third minute. I can let myself go now. Anyway, that'll do for part one. Part two will begin at Villa Park.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Aston Villa 1, Liverpool 3 then. A really open game. Both sides had loads of chances. Darwin Núñez had loads of chances. Green South says, I know Núñez has scored before. I've seen him do it. Why is it every time he shoots, I'm certain he'll miss? As I'm typing this, he literally missed again. Chris, could Darwin Núñez have scored Barry's header? It's a great question. He's really important, Lars Núñez, to this team, isn't he? And he played well. And look, Liverpool won. And it seems strange, I guess, to start with Darwin Núñez. But he was sort of the headline of this game.
He was. I mean, I'm finding myself having to go on the thesaurus.com to look for words here, because it's like, I feel like we've said the word chaotic too many times. We need to sort of mix it up a bit. So I've got here other words for chaotic. It's disorganized. I mean, maybe turbulent. That seems okay. Deranged. That doesn't quite work. Rampageous. That's a good one. Let's go with that. The rampageous Darwin Núñez. I like him. I think he's very good.
Yeah, yeah,
I mean, you say jokes about whether he'll ever score goals. I mean, he's scored 5 goals in 10 games in the Premier League so far. I think it's just because he gets into a lot of positions and his finishing is inconsistent, shall we say so. And he offers you so much in terms of the hard work he does off the ball. He creates chances by his presence and all the movements he makes. If he puts away a tap-in at the far post, we don't have this conversation. He would talk about how much other great stuff he does. I think he's good. I think, if this was in a team where you had no goals coming from anywhere else, it might be a bit of a problem. But you still have Mo effing Salah on the flank, who's going to score a ton of goals for you. You have other good wide forwards in the group, adding yet another one as well now with the transfer news happening. And I think having him as a sort of super sort of mobile, hardworking focal point up front, I think it's good. I like it.
On Darwin, Max, I was lucky enough last season to see the both legs of the Benfica ties against Liverpool. And I saw him kind of live and up front. And I remember seeing him a lot of talk about this Darwin Núñez. Okay, I've heard a little bit about him. I'm going to see him up front and up close and see how good this guy really is. And I remember walking away from both the fixtures thinking, he's a good player. For someone that's very tall, very big, he's very quick on the ball, takes up very good positions. But I wasn't blown away. I wasn't like, yeah, that's the guy. That's the next hot guy in Europe to go and sign. I thought, good player, but not great. And what I'm seeing from him now is, and this might sound very, very mean, and I'm sorry for it being so mean, but I get Lukaku vibes from him in that I think he'll score goals, but I think he's going to miss a lot of chances as well. I'm not sure he's the guy that was sold to me by the experts and by fellow fans that watched him about a year ago. I don't see that guy that is in the same category or could be as a Haaland.
Hard to please, aren't you,
Jordan? Well, I'm just being honest. I think he's a good striker, but I just don't see the guy that everybody told me, this is the next hot striker. And I just don't see that guy.
Producer Joel says he's only 23. He reasonably gets so many chances and there aren't enough fun, chaotic players about, so we should just embrace it. I mean, at the game itself, John, I was really quite open, wasn't it? Villa really contributed to this game and it sort of started incredibly. It felt like the first 5 minutes, it was sort of extra time or whatever. Just chances everywhere.
Again, we'd learned nothing because we found that Liverpool are quite vulnerable in defence, even with, Virgil van Dijk scored a very nice goal, but defensively, I'm still not sure about the great Virgil van Dijk this season. And of course, Trent is in the team. Let's cast that aside for a debate another day. But I did think that if Villa had slightly better functioning forwards, they might have got a bit more out of that game. Leon Bailey, there's a frustrating player.
Mm.
Talented, but yeah, he makes Darwin Nunes look like Mo Salah, really, doesn't he? And Ollie Watkins did score, but again, I mean, I think Ollie Watkins, I've seen him play a couple of times in the flesh, and I think he's obviously a very talented player. And you can see he causes defenders problems, but again, if there was a bit more of a cutting edge, he would be a serious proposition. I think if Villa got forwards, there's a lot within that team, and I think Liverpool were not that comfortable in that game. And that's because of the defensive problems. But I suppose playing against Darwin Nunes must be quite difficult, because no one's got a clue what's going to happen there, have they?
Before we get angry Liverpool fans in the comments rightly pointing out, we should be a little bit more complimentary about some of the stuff they were doing, I thought, because the first goal is amazing, right? I mean, just the sheer quality, yeah, so involved in the first goal. And there's some of the passing movements they put together were super impressive. But it was also one of those games. I think we've all had the feeling over Boxing Day and now, is that you're sort of just trying to go through your brain, like, where were we with those teams? Who were good? Who were bad? What's actually happening? And this was kind of a good game. So this is exactly what Liverpool were in the first half of the season. They're a team who at times are absolutely magnificent going forward and can put together some moves that are just, you know, right up there with the very best in the world right now. But they are a little bit unreliable down the other end, and they weren't fully punished by Villa as they could have been. But they do probably need to tighten up, and that's, I'm sure, Jurgen Klopp is very, very aware of that.
Jim says, Trent getting it launched with the outside of his foot for Liverpool's first. Surely the greatest way to score a goal. I just don't think that can be classed under the getting it launched.
No.
No, everyone's shaking their head. Elliot says, in his Villa career to date, Robin Olsen has conceded goals at a rate of one every 23 minutes. Have the panel ever been certain they can do their job despite evidence to the contrary? I just never really noticed if Robin Olsen was good or not good, if I'm being honest. And Ben Doak came on for Liverpool, born on the 11th of November 2005. You Raise Me Up by Westlife was number one. Robin says, Gakpo to Liverpool, good or great transfer? PSV and Liverpool have agreed on a proposed transfer of Cody Gakpo. This is from PSV's Twitter. The 23-year-old attacker will leave for England imminently, where he will be subjected to the necessary formalities. God, it sounds quite brutal, doesn't it? ahead of the completion of the transfer. Lars, I mean, look, a lot of people who dip in and out of European football probably don't watch the Eredivisie, but have seen, you know, watched him at the World Cup, right? He's an excellent player, Cody Gakpo.
Yeah, I'm not going to pretend I watch the Eredivisie every weekend. That's clearly not true, but I do.
If anyone could pretend it would be you, I would say.
No, well, yeah, I pick up the occasional game, and I've watched them in the Europa League a couple of games. He is a sort of left-sided attacking player, plays mostly on the left wing, but he's young enough that you could feasibly mold him into something else. People will get distracted by his height. He's quite tall, but he isn't a big, you know, big physical player. He doesn't use that frame very much. He is a sort of typical left-sided attacking for a winger who likes to cut in and use his right foot. He strikes the ball very cleanly, both in terms of shots and in terms of crosses. He's a very good player. The only question I would ask is, when everyone's fit, do you look at this Liverpool team and think what we really need to spend a lot of money on right now is a left-sided, right-footed attacker? This is like, I feel like that's, you know, you've re-signed Mo Salah. He's going to play every game he can walk on the right. And you've spent a pile of money on Darwin Nunes, so the plan is for him to be your first choice up front for the foreseeable. And then you kind of have Diaz and Diogo Jota fighting it out for minutes on the left wing, and that sort of looks pretty balanced. And then you bring in another big money player in that position. You've in the last 18 months, you've spent quite a lot of money on Jota and Diaz.
Sorry, Lars, but I think your earlier point answers that question. I think they will mould him into a centre-forward. I think they'll move on Firmino and Jota in the summer. And I think he'll be the backup to Nunes, if you like.
I mean, I've seen... you're changing a lot about the way he plays. Again, don't let the height fool you. He definitely isn't a sort of physical focal point kind of guy. You have to change a lot about how he plays football. And I think spending, what, 50 million or something on a guy to ask him to do something completely different to what he's done previously in his career is kind of slightly strange behavior. It's possible they'll do that. But for me, it suggests more that, I don't know, maybe there's some, I mean, they know more about the injuries to Diaz and or Jota than we do. Maybe the health situation there is more serious than previously assumed.
Gav says, given Spurs' performance today, and bearing in mind I'm still listening to pre-World Cup episodes of the pod, is it necessary to record any new Spurs material? I think Spurs are silly, Lars, aren't they? 9 games in a row where they've conceded the first goal. I actually thought on this one that they were going to change their tactics to be bad first half and bad second half. They just took a bit more time in the second half to get going. But it was vintage. They didn't really do anything. They did get a point they could have won, but I don't really know what to say about them anymore.
I don't know how many times we can get away with saying the same thing over and over again, but it does seem that their plan is to sort of keep it tight, don't take any risks in the first half, and then sort of turn the screw in the second, you know, increase the tempo, win the game in the second half. But that plan is just constantly undermined by the fact that, you know, nothing stupid first 45. They're not capable of that. There's too much stupidity. You know, they're just not, you know. This idea of just them sort of keeping it tight for a while, they can't do it. They're not keeping it tight. They always inevitably concede goals, often quite stupid goals, and then they have to go on the front foot. And lo and behold, when they do go on the front foot, they look much better for doing so. I mean, this is a totally meaningless stat, I guess, but I've looked at, like, what would the table be if only the second half counted? You know, if the league table of only things that happened between the 46th and 90th minute. Tottenham are top of that table. in just second halves, they've won 11, drawn 2, and lost 3. So they'd be in front of Arsenal and Man City, who, of course, haven't always had to win the second half because they're frequently well in the lead by then. I don't think it's now. Like, listen, I'm not going to sit here and mansplain football to Antonio Conte. That would be ridiculous. You know, Conte believes in this way of approaching the games. It's very difficult to do this sort of nothing stupid first 45 when you have defenders who do quite as many stupid things as Tottenham have.
Yeah, I mean, especially, I mean, Eric Dyer's shin to give away the corner is probably the high point of the day. It's utterly tremendous. There's another thing about it, and I speak from a kind of Spurs supporting position, which is, it's actually not enjoyable, this kind, you know, like, because even if you do end up winning, you basically just spend like four, you know, I'm texting my dad and we've got, oh, this is a grind again, isn't it? There's no, like, you know, like, so when you, even if you do get something, you sort of think the best way to win a game is to be 2-0 down and win 3-2, but actually it would be really nice to just go from the start, Jordan.
With that grinding of a point or over an eventual win will translate to the players, and they will after a while start thinking, this is not cool. And even wins won't feel like wins. I remember Conte's latter period at Chelsea, it went sour really quickly, but the whole adage is that, you know, Jose had it as well. When you're playing crap, but you're winning games and therefore titles, you can tolerate it for a little while. But Tottenham are even winning trophies at the moment to kind of get through and pacify the kind of grinding football. So I just wonder how long the players will kind of be like, this is not the way we want to play football. They've got some good players. They've got some good attacking players there. And we're just not seeing it. I get why Conte plays the way he plays. But equally, I think if he's not careful, he will lose those players very soon.
We doff our cap to Robin Cowan. As Mark said, Robin Cowan just dropped Get It Launched into the commentary.
Yes.
Definitely done for the pod fans. George said she sounded anti-Get It Launched. We'll need to get her official stance. We will next time she's on. And Brentford don't just get it launched, John, but they do quite often get it launched to Ivan Toney, who is, I mean, absolute. He's so good at that job, isn't he? He's so strong, and then he's got the skill as well to bring the ball down and bring others into play.
Yeah, and obviously a good finisher as well. Ivan Toney, well, a player I suspect we'll be talking about in a little more detail for different reasons, but there's no doubting his talent. There's no doubting his worth to Brentford, I should say, and should those difficulties go against him, Brentford are going to miss him. Can we talk about the dive?
Mbeumo's dive, yeah, of course.
I mean, wow. I mean, that's got to be dive of the season, hasn't it? I mean, you know.
Well, the only mitigating circumstances is he sort of laughed himself very soon after doing it. It wasn't like he dived and went down like he'd been like he knew straight away.
So actually, that maybe that's worse then. He can't even. He didn't even have the courage of his convictions in it. Yeah.
Yeah, possibly.
I mean, it looked hilarious. It really did look hilarious.
Yeah. It does look hilarious. What I just want to say is that players do that more often than we think, but just usually they do manage to get a little bit of contact, and then everybody says, "Oh well, it's contact, it's a foul." A ton of penalties. If you look very closely at the player's actual movements, it's very clear that they've decided to fall down. that's what players tend to do.
And then move their leg into, and it's actually quite hard not to hit Fraser Forster, isn't it? If you think about
it. Yeah, it's just what's basically done him here is that Forster manages to stop his momentum in time so that he just about doesn't touch him, and it ends up looking really stupid.
I found the probably not important part of this game, but the sort of shadow and the sun just with an early kickoff. I just don't think Brentford should be allowed to have early kickoffs.
It wasn't very flattering for the groundsman.
No, it did look really bobbly, didn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It looked like they'd held the Horse of the Year show over Christmas or something.
Anyway, there we go. We'll repeat that Spurs chat after every Spurs game for the rest of the season. Crisis club Everton. They lost 2-1 at home to Wolves. Michael says, is a heartbreaking last minute loss to the bottom side all the proof we need that Frank Lampard just gets Everton? Autumn Floric, which was sad? Which was the sadder violin, the small one playing for Frank Lampard or the one played by Max's neighbour? Yeah, like, you know, my flat in London, my neighbour has been learning the violin for about 3 years, you know, and I'm away from this quite a lot, and you just think he'd improve. And also, 9:45 in the evening is too late to be playing the violin badly, in my book. I actually thought, Lars, that Everton had the chances to win this game, and they were slightly unlucky.
Again, I really it's become the season of repeating yourself, but like, yeah, Everton, Max, they worked really hard. They had some chances, they didn't take them, and they conceded goals. And I kind of. It's really hard to get the words out. I kind of feel for Frank Lampard a little bit here. I didn't think they were dreadful, but you are coming out of this big World Cup break. You're not in a great place in the table. You know, things are a little bit uncertain and you're playing the bottom team at home. You really need to not lose that game. And the chances that were had were not taken. And listen, I'm not saying they played super well, but they weren't abysmal by any means. It's just not quite happening for them. And there was a sort of little detail in, I think it was Andy Hunter's post match report on the Big Guardian website about how they started with a front three of Dwight McNeil, Neil Maupay, and Anthony Gordner, and that was a front three fit for a relegation fight. But I'm just thinking, yeah, you paid quite a lot of money for Dwight McNeil. You've also just fairly recently signed Neil Maupay for 15 million, which isn't nothing when you're a bottom half team. And you rejected, what, 40 million for Anthony Gordon? So, you know, this is a front three it's not nothing, you know, what you're dealing with here. But it's clear that they do lack a little bit of cutting edge up front and a little bit of creativity in midfield. It does appear that way.
It took Frank Lampard 75 minutes to speak to the press. So any sympathy you did have for him, it wouldn't have had it if you were one of those journalists waiting, Lars, more than an hour to hear Frank Lampard say, yeah, we're a bit unlucky. I would have gone home. I'd have said to my editor, I am not staying for this. We're not going to get... He said they were desperately unlucky to lose. He always knew this year was going to be tough. They've won 1 in 8. They play Man City on Saturday, Jordan. They will stick with him, won't they?
I think they will. I can't work out who's failing who there, because whilst Everton have been a bit of a nothing club for a long time now, I don't particularly rate Frank Lampard either. So I don't know if Everton are actually not doing what they need to do to help Frank Lampard succeed, or if he's just not good enough for that particular job. The squad isn't particularly great. It's okay. But come on, you're losing. I agree with you, Max. They weren't bad. But when you're losing at home to Wolves, that's not a good look. But I think they will stick with him, yeah.
Yeah, but talking of Andy's report, actually, I did like the fact he described Frank Lampard as looking physically ill when Ike Nouri turned Traore's cross in for the goal, which I think is a great description. I just wanted to make a point about Julian Lopetegui, of course. You know,
please do.
Impressively tight trousers for Boxing Day, I have to say. And I was like, there's a man of confidence and, you know, made sure of his dietary supplements on Christmas Day. I thought, when he was jumping around, I thought those could go at any point, man, you know. But
I mean, I did want to say, did we see anything different from Wolves?
Very but, tight you know, trousers.
We saw something different from his trousers.
Well, they did look good on the attack, as to be said, yeah. And he's a manager, of course, Lars is the oracle here. He's a manager of considerable reputation, though we probably know him best for the for that Spain Madrid mix-up of a few years ago. But there's no doubt that he is a manager probably of a higher class than they've had. And he's actually the manager they wanted at the very start of their experiment. Yeah. They needed to win as well, if you think about it. So good stuff, good start for him. But yeah, if I was Andy and I'd had to wait 75 minutes, I would not be happy.
It does make the bottom of the table utterly fascinating. We'll do... you know, the Southampton's defeat in part three, but, you know, Southampton are bottom on 12 and what Crystal Palace are 11th on 19. I mean, if Brentford only got a point more than them, I'm going ruling Chelsea out of a relegation dogfight, perhaps unwisely, but like it's so tight. So hopefully it stays that tight for the rest of the season. Anyway, that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll begin with Fulham's win at Crystal Palace.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Palace 0, Fulham 3. Fulham are good, Lars, aren't they?
Fulham good. Definitely helps when your opponents get two players sent off. I mean, that's
does make a difference.
It does, but no, they're good. Mitrovic is back in, sort of picked up where he left off in terms of just being a menace. Tim Ream scoring a goal. And Tim...
What a kit as well.
I guess. Again, the sartorial stuff, Max. I don't have much to add.
No, a hit. What a hit.
That, what a kit. I'm like, well, it's the Fulham. It's the Fulham shirt. What are you talking about?
It's just
about?
A Fulham kit. Different to the kit. It was a great strike.
It was a great strike by Tim Ream. And if you're Tim Ream, surely there's a moment where you worry that the clock will strike midnight and Tim Ream will immediately transform into a pumpkin or something. What has happened to
or
this
just
guy?
Back into Tim Ream.
I'm hoping basically. Someone who's a you know, a good journalist who works on the Fulham beat can have a big interview with Tim Ream and ask him, mate, what happened? Because he looks so good. Not just obviously scoring the goal, but he also looked really good playing for the US in the World Cup, I thought. And I know, obviously, being a centre half, you're a little bit at the mercy. That made it sound like I'm a centre half. I know that if you are a centre half, you are a little bit at the mercy of what happens in front of you. And I know that from speaking to centre halves who have played both in organised and disorganised teams. And, you know, and obviously, if you have Joao Palhinha in front of you and you have a team that makes sense, it's easier to beat Tim Ream than it was the last time Fulham were up, where it was very difficult to beat Tim Ream. But he just doesn't look like the same player. There's something that's really happened there.
I believe Tim Ream's got a podcast. So
is it about football? Is it about true crime? Is Tim Ream going, you know, unsolved? It's called Indirect with Tim Reeve and Steve Schlanger, who I presume Steve Schlanger, it sounds like he just missed out on the Ryder Cup team this year, but you know, won the Pittsburgh Invitational, didn't he? Deep dives into the most interesting issues in the world of soccer, which arguably we occasionally do. Don't
we? Yeah. Yeah, so someone should competition, attempt to do that. Tim Reeve. Yeah.
Palace are, you know, you've got to feel for Tyrick Mitchell, don't you, Jordan? Like he looked absolutely disconsolate after that absolutely slightly unfortunate but horrendous challenge.
Yeah, he did look like a semi-broken man after that. I mean, he tried to win the ball, but I don't know how he ended up doing what he ended up doing. I don't think he knew either. So that was unfortunate. I just think it was a general bad day for Palace overall. And I hope that it doesn't begin the start of a poor Christmas run that then triggers a downward. There's always one team that starts the season quite well and then after Christmas kind of just like falls off a cliff. And I really hope it's not Crystal Palace because I just think, well, they're my local club anyway. And I like Patrick Vieira, A, because I'm an Arsenal fan, but I like the job he's done there. So I'd like to see this be the trigger for a kind of downward slope of form. But yeah, I think we should hopefully write it off as a bad day at the office all round.
Just briefly on the second sending off, James Tompkins. Tarek Mitchell did the whole mea culpa shirt over the head, you know I've committed.
He kept putting the shirt over his head, didn't he? Like really kept doing it. Like I'm really so sad about this.
The opposite of that was James Tompkins' look of absolute innocence of when he'd completely shoved his elbow in the face of a speeding, I think it was Mitrovic, wasn't it? Yes. And that was his first game since last Boxing Day. So our first start, so unlucky James Tompkins.
Yeah, I imagine James Tompkins has done that many times and not been sent off for it,
yeah.
Hasn't he? A word on George Cohen. There was a minute's pause before, I think, every game in the Premier League, but obviously a complete Fulham legend. He died on the 23rd of December, 83 years old, played every minute for England in 1966. Spent his entire club at Fulham, 459 appearances between 1956 and 1969 before he retired through injury at the age of 29. George Best called him the best fullback he ever played against. And you will have probably read and heard some of the tributes for George Cohen. Look, one of just 11 men to lift the World Cup for England. But by all accounts, a truly lovely man and completely grounded and completely understated. And when he talked about his footballing ability, he was clearly super talented and was sort of quite, like an attacking fullback. But he was very much, I just got the ball and gave it to Bobby Charlton. So completely humble about everything that he achieved. And quite extraordinary to win one trophy in your career and that be the World Cup, you know. Our thoughts with his family and friends, of course. To St Mary's, Southampton 1, Brighton 3. Nathan Jones, first game in charge of Southampton. They're bottom now, booed off at half time. Jordan, has quite a job to do, doesn't he?
He does. In our Premier League preview shows, I predicted Southampton were one of my three to go down. I think they're a team that over the last 4 or 5 years haven't evolved. I actually was a fan of Hasenhüttl, but they didn't really evolve. And I think we're seeing when you don't evolve, you get caught up and you end up getting caught in the churn. And I think they're going to go this year. I don't know what they're about. And Jones has got a big job on trying to galvanise them for a fight that, as I mentioned, I think they're going to end up losing. And this was a game where... I think there was a stat that said that they've had the least amount of players at the World Cup of all the Premier League clubs. I have to double check, fact check that, but... I don't know what they've been doing. Brighton are a good team, but they look like they're all over the place from the start. So, yeah, I think they're in big trouble.
Yeah, I'm not sure I can fully agree that they've not evolved. They brought in like 8 players in the window in the summer. But the key is that they went really young. I mean, they were mostly like, 19, 20-year-olds. I mean, very young guys. And they clearly, I mean, there's been a change of ownership there. Rasmus Ankersen, who was a part of the sort of Brentford rise up the leagues, is involved with the club now. I'm guessing they're going to try to do a sort of similar to Brentford, sort of let's look at numbers and let's buy cheap and sell high and this sort of thing. And they've gone really young in the market this summer. And that's dangerous, you know. That can pay off in the long run. And you look at their squad and they have a lot of sort of highly rated young players who could be very good in a couple of years. But they need to not get relegated in the meantime, and clearly they're in a tricky situation in the league, I don't disagree that they could absolutely get relegated. They've taken a big risk in terms of the direction they've gone, and also in terms of appointing Nathan Jones. Now Nathan Jones, for the work he's done at Luton, definitely one of those managers who I think deserves a shot in the Premier League. But it's still a bit of a risk to bring him up into this division when he's coming into a team that again has a lot of young players and not a lot of sort of guys who can pull stuff along for you, and it's tricky.
Solly March's goal was excellent. And that was Adam Lallana's second ever headed goal in the Premier League. Very much a Trevor Brooking. He's having a brilliant season, actually, Lallana, isn't he? Like a lot of these sort of Brighton players, you think, oh, well, that's your career sort of on the slide, Danny Welbeck, etc. But it's nonsense. They've been superb, John.
Well, he's always been a good player. And I know that Philippe is a particular enthusiast for Lallana. He's just got that... The sprinkling gifts that we probably don't associate with an Englishman, funny enough. A good non-celebration celebration from him. Two things. Mitoma did that thing that we're going to see maybe a little bit of, and it's realised that this guy that was good in the World Cup plays in the Premier League. On the subject of Solly March. Now, Solly March is one of those players that we must always refer to by both names. So I once tweeted out saying, does his mum call him Solly March? And his mum replied to me. His mum replied to me.
Oh, really?
And she said, No, I call him Solomon. So there you go.
Ah, that's wonderful. Yeah, sort of Benicophobia, I feel, is absolutely in that bracket of you must use their whole name. This was one of those, if you're in the UK, this was on Amazon Prime, this. First of all, this is my incompetence, but the fact that I clicked on it wasn't that I had to scroll through movies, like, you know, British movies, horror, catastrophe movies, thrillers, box sets, jovial Christmas films. I'm late for Brentford Spurs. I just want it right in front of me. I guess, you know, that's just a problem for me, and I eventually found it. And I don't know what we made of a whole day. I prefer, Lars, not having the choice, really. I don't like the choice.
Yeah, I think having three different broadcasters on one league is... it's something that I struggle a little bit to get my head around. The fact that you basically have to have three subscriptions to follow a single division, that seems a bit wild. And that's nothing against Amazon or any of the people working involved in their coverage. It's just, for me, that's too much. That's not how it should be happening.
Mm. And Martin Keown seems to be on telly all day.
Martin Keown is still talking.
He's still going. It's a tough old gig, you know. I mean, he started at 11 and was he still there at 11 p.m. on like a different channel?
So there's a real danger that if you open Amazon on your computer, you will immediately get Martin Keown lamenting the death of defending in the modern game and the scourge of.
Justin was in touch to say on the subject of draft excluders. As an Antipodean, listening to your Christmas special, I was absolutely shocked to learn that the term draft excluder was in reference to long pieces of fabric you use to keep out drafts, which makes perfect sense, as they're almost surplus to requirements here in sunny Australia. I assumed the footballing term draft excluder was the same as draft dodger, as in the man on the floor is excluded from the responsibility of standing in the firing line of the wall, i.e. the draft.
I also thought that on a pod once, and I felt so stupid, I actually asked you to take it out, which, if you listen to the pod, you'll know I've sounded super stupid so many times that I don't often ask for things to be taken out. In that particular time, I did.
But it really kind of works, doesn't it? He is the draft excluder.
Well, I guess that's why I felt like he's the one who doesn't want to stand in the wall. He wants to sort of hide behind people's legs.
Yeah, he's the Donald Trump of this.
But then again, is it better or worse to have your back to it when the shot's coming in? And like, either this will wallop you on the back of the head or it won't. I mean, I think I'd prefer to be facing it.
As yet, a draft excluder, I don't think, has ever been hit. It doesn't mean they're not worth having, because obviously it means the player can't roll it under the wall. But I think you're in a very safe spot as a draft excluder. Thank you very much to Matt Ablett, who has made a graphic of Barry's header, as discussed on this year's Christmas special and the previous two as well. He's got Littleton down the left wing, Glenn Denning horizontal, just standing there with his head, and Beaver in goal. So thank you so much. Maybe we'll make a T-shirt of Barry's header. Coulter got in touch to say, have you seen this? Bloody Americans. An American fan did actually hang a catch by an NFL wide receiver in the Louvre. Well, he actually caught his phone up, and it was a NFL wide receiver, Justin Jefferson of the Minnesota Vikings. I don't know, Lars, if he's good or not, but he seems to be very good at catching the ball. Anyway, he stuck his phone up in the Louvre, and I have issues about people saying hang things in the Louvre. Speaking of art galleries, John, you appreciated this. I went to Amsterdam on a mini break, and I saw a painting of Richard Keys in the Rijksmuseum from the 1680s. It was truly remarkable. It was actually a painting of Michiel de Ruyter, who was... that is in Dutch on Wikipedia. That's beyond my capabilities.
Should we have a guess at what he was? That's more interest. Was he some sort of merchant?
I mean, wasn't everyone a merchant in like 1667?
Well, in the Netherlands, you'd expect so, yeah. But some sort of dissident nobleman, disgraced, and maybe sent to operate in the Middle East.
He was a Dutch admiral, widely regarded and celebrated as one of the most skilled admirals in history, Michiel Adriaanszoon de Ruyter. He's arguably most famous for his achievements with the Dutch Navy during the Anglo-Dutch Wars. He fought the English and French forces, scored several critical victories, with the raid on the Medway being the most famous among them.
Oh, right, yeah. Dark forces at work. And it was just banter, yeah.
From merchant to banter merchant is what I was hoping, but there we go.
There we are. Anyway, we do need to finish with an apology. You might remember the World Cup final. Barney Ronay joined us after the World Cup final from the stadium. I mentioned at the start of his chat, the only place that he could hear us and we could hear him was actually from a disabled toilet. After podcast, Liam from the charity Level Playing Field emailed us and said, look, as someone who's a long-time listener, this was a very disappointing thing to hear, especially from a podcast that's gone out of its way to talk about equality and inclusion. For Barney to record in an accessible toilet, no matter how innocent it was on his part, is an act that's has a damaging effect on disabled people. It's the only bathroom a disabled person can use. We're sure that Barney didn't go into that bathroom to cause anyone to wait, but the moment he closes that door, he's excluding a disabled person from conducting an act that most non-disabled people take for granted. Everyone is responsible for making the game accessible and inclusive for disabled sports fans and disabled sports journalists. Delivering this shouldn't fall on one person's shoulders, but should be a collective effort. With this in mind, we'd welcome the opportunity to talk more about disability with you, Max, and Barry, and the other panelists, and how we all, disabled and non-disabled, have our parts to play to make sure that football is for everyone, not the selected few. It's a really good point that you bring up. I mean, if there are mitigating circumstances, and if they count for anything, it's that we actually recorded that bit out of time. So it was about an hour and a half after the trophy lift. We'd finished the pod. I waited for Barney to finish his piece. And even though there was lots of loud music blaring, there was actually nobody there in the stadium. But I think the way I flippantly said it, and no listener would know that we'd done it out of that time sequence, so it would give the impression that, you know, we didn't care where he was. But in terms of disability in football, access to grounds, representation in the media, lots of things, good things that clubs are doing now, it's something we haven't really covered in detail on this pod, and we plan to do it. It's a very fair message that you sent, and our sincere apologies. Anyway, that'll do for today's pod. We'll be back in a couple of days because the football is relentless, isn't it? At this time, it's always relentless, let's face it. But for the time being, thank you, Lars.
Anytime, Max.
Thanks, Jordan.
Cheers, mate.
Thank you, John.
Thanks for having me, Max.
Football Weekly was produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Danielle Stevens.
This is The Guardian.